All right, I'm going to introduce Cliff. His home group is Altered Boys from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. As I said earlier, I've always enjoyed listening to various speakers from around the world, especially this past year during the COVID lockdown. And back in March, I had a new, there's a podcast, it's called Sobercast, and it popped up on my phone, and their speaker on that podcast for that day was Cliff from Oklahoma. And the message that Cliff had delivered through that podcast was something that really stuck with me. I'm not going to go into any detail because he's the star of the show this evening, and he might, say something that I don't want to say. So I'm tired. I had shared some stuff with Liz, and Liz was on Sinless Sober Mania committee, and she was like, "Hey, we're looking for a speaker chair. You know, is that something you might think about?" And I was like, "You know, I need to do some service work because I was stuck." And so I signed up for it. And so I internet stalked Cliff, found his cell phone number. It's interesting what you can find out on a person with just their first name, their last initial, and the word Oklahoma or whatever. So Google yourself. And so I sent him a text, and I mean like instantaneously. He's like, "Wendy, can you call me?" You know, and so I did. And we had this wonderful conversation over the phone, and his enthusiasm, which y'all have already all seen for the AA program, it was just so amazing. And so I know y'all are really excited to hear his message this evening. So y'all welcome Cliff.
Hey, everybody, I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001. For that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. It's good to be in Louisiana, huh? And I want to tell you thank you so much for the hospitality that you all have shown Lori and I this weekend. It's just great. It's absolutely wonderful. I want to thank Wendy for the text and the phone calls and staying in touch with us the whole time. And the basket that we got is just wonderful. And I'm thinking this suit used to fit before I came here. And I'm a little nervous, Kath, from here on out. And just been great. And it's been wonderful. And everybody's just been great. And so thank you so much on behalf of Lori and I for having us down here and asking us to come over and spend a weekend with you. It's been really a treat. You know, I'm a selfish alcoholic. You know, we show up at things like this, and there's a registration table out front, a literature table. The Al-Anons and the AAs are out there. They got shirts for sale. People are manning the booths, the raffles, all the baskets put together. And you come in here, and there's a program, and the program's all put together, and it runs, and everybody stands up. And I'm a selfish alcoholic. You know, I show up for these things and just take full advantage of them, forgetting that all year long people have been getting together, having committee meetings, making sure that we get here this weekend and take advantage of all that. We have all this smooth running and laid out all for us, the service that's been done so that we can come here this weekend and enjoy all this, that we can come here and be part of something, you know. And I've been a taker all my life. And to come here and have the opportunity to be part of this. My hat's off to you all. You did a great job of putting this together. And give yourself a hand because you deserve it for all the hard work you did this weekend. So we're thankful to be here. It's been great to be spend some time with John and Kathy. It's been great to do that. And I don't know, I hope that most of you got to hear John's talk on Friday night. Lori and I got in a little late. We were afraid we were going to miss it, but we got here just when he started. And so we got to hear that. It was, if you didn't hear it, you missed a trick. And I encourage you to buy the CD sets when they came out, because it was absolutely great AA talk, and you need to hear that. And I hope you all got to hear my wife's talk this morning. I hope you got to hear her message. It's certainly a message of hope. I tell people she's the one with real recovery here. I'm kind of the clown show of this deal, but she's got a solid message of hope. And I know that Kathy's talk in the morning is going to be phenomenal. And like the airlines are doing these days, Lori and I were supposed to fly out of here at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening, but we got this deal, we're moved, we got changed, so have to fly out at like 10-something tomorrow, so we're going to miss Kathy. But I encourage you, I want you to be here. Don't sell yourself short and come tonight and say, oh, Sunday morning, I'm going to sleep in. Don't sell yourself short. Don't sell yourself short of what God may have for you tomorrow. And show up and let's hear what Kathy has to say tomorrow. So easy for us not to show up on Sunday mornings. But come hear what powerful message she's going to have to deliver for it. I'm sorry that we have to go back early. I apologize to you all as a committee, but you know, airlines are what they are these days. And so I got to catch a flight when I can get home, and I got stuff to do tomorrow on Monday, so I got to get home. But I've already made my apologies to Kathy that we couldn't be here to hear her tomorrow. But thanks again for the hospitality. It's absolutely wonderful. Here's something I can tell you, and I'm willing to bet my whole sobriety on it, is this morning, if we took a pen and we dropped it right here at this podium and took some string and we went out probably a half a mile and we drew a big circle with the string and we began to knock on doors, we wouldn't have to knock on very many doors till we would find a scenario that looks something like this. That this morning at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, there was somebody sitting at a kitchen table. And they were sitting there looking in that coffee cup that they've been staring into for the past 20 or 30 minutes. In the back of the house, in another room, there was a kid or two back there trying to be really, really quiet. Afraid to make too much noise. And somewhere around 10:30 or 11 this morning, the other person in that house came to. And they came out to the front where that other person was sitting at the kitchen table looking into their coffee cup. And they sat down across from them. And there was that moment of where they just sat for a minute. And the one that just came to, finally, when the other one looked up, said something like this, "I am so sorry. I'm so sorry." I don't know how that happened. I have no idea how that happened. I was just going to go out for a couple of beers. And I am so sorry that that happened. And I'm going to tell you something. That person has no more idea how that happened than a man in the moon. But here's the thing that I can absolutely guarantee you and willing to bet my entire sobriety on. That same person who wandered in late to that table this morning is at home right now drunk. And absolutely has no more idea about how that happened than they did the night before. After making the solemn oath that they would never do that again. Not knowing that not too far from where they sit tonight, the answer to the riddle that they've been trying to figure out sits right here at this hotel that's been going on all weekend here. The very answer that they don't even know that they're even looking for, but yet they yearn for, that somewhere inside themselves, just as it did all of us, that ache that we had inside of all of us at some point in time in our drinking. That what I like in the chapter of vision for you when it talks about, and only alcoholics really get that, the chilling vapors of loneliness settle down. And so why do we get together? Why do we come together like this? Why do we gather up in one spot and laugh and cut up and joke? And why do we have raffles? Why do we fly people in to come bring us inspirational messages of hope? We do that because what I know is that when we go back to our home groups, either tomorrow night or Monday or whenever our home group meets, it's boots on the ground. Because it's the next wave of insanity that's getting ready to crash our doors. And we need weekends like this to remind ourselves why we do this. We need weekends like this to remind us, to recharge us, to refuel us, to rejuice us. To remind us of, hey, we are the front line. We're what sometimes can stand between a life of misery and be the lifeline of hope for the yet people who have not heard the good news, the gospel of Alcoholics Anonymous over here. And that's why we get together and we do this. And that's why it's important. You know, I was just taken aback by all the new people that are involved in this conference this weekend. And if you keep staying involved in these conferences and things like this, you get to add up some time. It's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that people who come here and become active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not just the activities like this weekend, but getting involved in the actions in the book and carrying the message and coming together so we can have some fun like this. These are fun weekends, and they ought to be. The people who do that end up having this long-term sobriety like our friend John's talked about. Like we saw my friend Jimmy back there with 27 years. The people like that who come here and stay here are involved here. That's why we do this. That's why we have birthday nights. We come here for the newcomer. So when they walk in the door, they see not a glum lot, but people who are happy, joyous, and free. Happy. I'm going to tell you something. If this is not fun, I'm out. I'm going to be doing something else. If this is not fun, I'm out. I'm going to go find something else. But my experience is this could be fun here. I came to AA and thought my life is over, right? Not knowing it had just begun, without a clue that had been just begun. So, you know, what I know is this, is that from the time I was a little kid, and not because I had some kind of great insight at 5 years old, but looking back on my life through a process of inventories, what I can tell you is that I've always had that, what Dr. Silkworth described as restless, irritable discontentedness. You know, I can remember my mama took me to kindergarten when I was 5 years old, and she's had me spit shine, man. I mean, she took me to that little red schoolhouse out in West Texas, and I mean, she had me ready to go. We were early. And I remember her walking me through that door, and I don't know how many little kids were at those little low tables, you know, but I remember walking in there, and when she opened that door, all those little kids' heads shot up and looked at me. And I remember instantly the thoughts come to me like, man, these kids know the answers to all the questions, and I have no idea what book they're reading out of. It's like they knew the answers to the questions, and I have no idea. You know, and by the time I get to grade school, I'm looking around at kids, and I'm thinking things like, you know, if we lived in that house, you know, if my mom and dad drove that car, you know, if I could wear those clothes. You know, by the time I get to high school, I'm thinking, you know, if I was just a little taller, if I was a little more athletic, you know, if I could have that girl in my life, if those kids would let me run around with them. You know, if my brother was a little cooler like that guy's brother. You know, by the time I get to college, it's all the same stuff. And the time I get in the workforce, you know, I'm looking around at people thinking, you know, I don't belong here. I don't fit. I'm different from. And that kind of stuff has plagued me my whole life. And when I was 11 years old, because it's important for you to know I had 11 years of sobriety at one time. When I was 11 years old in a big old weeping willow tree down in southeast Oklahoma, some of y'all been down to Broken Bow. I grew up in Hugo, which is down in the southeast corner of the state. And under a big old weeping willow tree on a hot summer day, my brother opened up a tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. Anybody in here ever drank Country Club malt liquor? Well, that's God working in your life. That's all I'm saying. If you ever have to. My friend Joe, he says that he had stuff that he drank very first time. He had it sent off to have it analyzed. And he said it came back and it says, well, we have analyzed the materials you have sent us, and we're here to tell you that your horse has diabetes. And that's pretty much what it tasted like, I think. But I'm going to tell you, on that hot July day underneath that shade tree with my brother, I can tell you what I was wearing. I can tell you what my brother was wearing. I can still smell what it smelled like on that hot July day in Oklahoma. You know, I can see the sweat off that can. And I can tell you that because what happened to me on that day, the effect that alcohol produced in me on the day, had such a profound effect. You know, it was the effect that our book talks about, that one day I'd be willing to chase to the gates of insanity and death. Such a profound, because the effect it had on me, the illusion that alcohol created in this alcoholic, was it gave me that sense that everything was okay. Silkworth described it as the sense of ease and comfort, like everything's all right. That the restless, irritable discontentment, the separateness I feel, that I feel, the distance I feel from you, in the moment when I began to drink, the effect it had was produce it. I'm okay. I'm with you. I'm with you. And little would I know that, you know, over time, that which on that one day would create in me this elusive feeling. One day it would do exactly what Bill described in his story, that it would turn on me like a boomerang in flight. And I want you to know my experience with drinking that in those early days was not on that day I would drink with my brother and I puked and blacked out and was into my social drinking. That's not my experience. But I can tell you this, by the time I got to high school, I'm a daily drinker. Now, the legal drinking age in Oklahoma when I was a kid growing up in high school was 21 for guys and 18 for gals. And but at 6:30 in the morning, the legal drinking age claim was old enough to get your money on the counter, man, you know. And I had a buddy of mine our senior year. We had a 0-hour class. It met at like 7. And we would get together and we would pool our money every day. We would buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers, the champagne, the bottle of beer. We would buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers and we would split those right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I'd get a cool buzz on and I could go to school and I could navigate through school feeling okay, you know, feeling all right. By the time I get to college, I'm a blackout drinker. And I don't understand. I think whatever I'm experiencing, I believe everybody experiences that, you know. I don't know that my experiences and the effect that alcohol has on me is different from everybody else. And I'm drinking, I think everybody else is experiencing and drinking exactly the way that I drink. Isn't that funny how we do that? The other day I was telling Lori, we were watching some TV show and they were somebody on there having a cocktail, because that sounds so sophisticated, doesn't it? We're going to have a cocktail. On TV, they're sippers. I just need to tell you that. And I looked at her, I said, see that guy drinking? I said, that's not how I drink. The way I drink is if you bring me a vodka rocks, I just chug it. I'm a drinker. I'm not a sipper. You need to know that. I'm a drinker. And I'm a blackout drinker. And blackout drinking is an experience. If you're not a blackout drinker, you may never know. But it's kind of fun because on Friday night, you start with this group of people. I start with Wayne. Wayne and I are out drinking, and sometimes in the wee morning hours of Saturday, I wake up with this group of people. And I come to, and I don't know whose turn it is to talk, and it's awkward. It's very strange, right? And I'm a full-blown alcoholic, but I don't even know what that means. And I get out in the workforce, and I'm just gone. I'm just gone. And my drinking is different. And I had people that drank with me, when I was in high school and college, and they looked a lot like me. We would come home from college, and we would come in for the 2 or 3 week break, and we would come home and we would drink. We would stay home till Christmas, because you need to get, you know, you need to rake in the goods, and then we're gone till New Year's. We're just out on a run for a week. We're gone. And we are burning it to the ground, man. And we would do that. We did that repeatedly. And then one day, the strangest thing happened to those people. They met him. They met her. They graduated and got these great jobs. And you know what they did? They just quit drinking. And the strangest part about that is they quit drinking and their lives got better. They started getting better jobs. They started getting raises at work. They started buying houses. They started having kids. They had those things called 401ks. I don't really know what that is. If you're a drinker, you ever look at your Social Security statement just for fun, right? Zeros. That's what I like. There's a dip here, man. And their lives got better. And you know what? I look at those people and thought, quitters. You know, just wimps. You know, just wimps. They don't, whatever, you know. Because I just think I like to party. That's what I think. I just like to go and have fun. And I'm going to tell you, I began to notice that my drinking was different. When I started working in downtown Oklahoma City, I worked in one of those big, tall office buildings in downtown Oklahoma City. And they would say to me, you know, hey, you want to go after work and have cocktails. Now, listen, when I had hair, I still had the hayseed in my hair and the bus ticket in my pocket. You know, I'm country. And cocktails sound sophisticated. And for a country kid, I'm thinking, yeah, I want to go do that. And I would say, well, what time are we going? And they would say, well, we'll go about 5:30. But what time you're going is important to alcoholics. Because if our buddy Wayne here said, listen, we're all going drinking tomorrow, and we're going at 9:00 tomorrow night, we'd be like, we're in. But I don't know about you, but I'm a real alcoholic. I don't wait to 9 to go drinking. about 6, I'm going to get ready to go drinking, right? I'm going to start drinking at 6 to get ready to go out at 9. And that's what we, so they would say 5:30, so at 4:30, I go get a table because I got a drink to get ready to drink with them. And so they show up, and there's only 3 of them that come down. They set a table. The cocktail waitress comes around, and she takes everybody's order. Of course, I'm an hour into the deal. And in about 15 minutes or so, she comes back around and asks the table what they want. And so he looks at the first person, and this guy's got about 3/4 of his drink gone. And she said, "Would you like another?" And he says something like this, "No, my wife's going to have dinner ready in about 45 minutes, and I need to get home." With a quarter of a drink in his glass, he gets up and pays his bill. Goes home, presumably to his wife. Has dinner with her. May or may not have another drink tomorrow, next month, next year, may never drink again. Then there's a second person there. Looks at her, said, "Would you like another?" Now, this lady has about a half of her drink left. She says something like this, "No, my daughter has a soccer game in 30 minutes, and I got to get there." With a half a drink sitting on the table, she gets up, pays her bill, gets in her car, goes to her daughter's soccer game, finds her before the game, gives her a hug, tells her she loves her, goes, sits in the stands with the other parents. This is important. Does not get thrown out during the soccer game. Afterwards, goes out with the other parents and the kids to have pizza. And she may or may not have another beer that night, may not have another drink tomorrow, next week, next month. I don't know. May never drink again. But then there's the third one. Now, this is the one that baffles me. This is the lady that's sitting there, and she's got about 3/4 of her drink left, or maybe it's the worst case scenario. Maybe the ice is melting and the booze is overflowing. Now, in this crowd, that's alcohol abuse. We get that, right? And she looked, when the waitress looks at her and says, "Would you like another?" She says the strangest thing of all. She says, no, I don't care for anymore. I'm beginning to feel it." Now, when I hear that, I think, okay. When you begin to feel it, you order tequila shooters, right? I mean, that's what you do. When you're starting to feel it, you got to go, man. It's because there's a window. When you start to feel it, there's a window that you got to get into, right? And what I can tell you today is that I know that the effect produced by alcohol in that lady is significantly different than the effect produced in me. Because what she's saying is she reached a point when she was drinking that she began to feel impaired. And she didn't want anymore. And see, that's not the effect that alcohol has in me. When I start to drink, I don't feel impaired. I begin to feel empowered. And I want another. And so the effect that alcohol produces in me is different. There's some things about my drinking that I can tell you about is that once I start drinking, there's 3 things that causes me to stop. Pass out, blackout, run out. Short of that, we're finishing the job. Anybody ever call you and say, "Hey, come over and let's have a beer." And they mean it, a beer. And you get there and you go to the fridge and you open it and there are 2 beers in the refrigerator. And get mad. And you can't even have that. I mean, you won't even start. I get pissed. 1 beer, I'm not even starting. I mean, it's not even worth it, right? I can't do that. I just get mad and leave. And the other piece about my drinking I can tell you about is that there's always a crash site. I don't know when it's going to be, where it's going to be, or who's going to be involved in it. But when I start drinking, there's always a crash site. And it's that piece of the puzzle, this idea that I had this allergy of the body, that once I start drinking, something different happens in me than 90% of the population. And we all know people, I mean, if you just resonate, this abnormal reaction to alcohol. And we know people that are like allergic to shellfish. God sake, if you're in Louisiana and you're allergic to shellfish, move, right? I mean, but we know people who are allergic to things like penicillin or bee stings or peanuts, for God's sakes. Peanut people, those are the ones that really get me for crying out loud. Peanut people. I mean, they eat one peanut and they make one emergency room visit. One. And the rest of their life, they walk around going, "Has a peanut been on this city block?" I mean, it's not enough to know if they've been in the restaurant. One emergency room visit. Man, let me tell you something. I'll give away cars, houses, jobs, careers, wives, families. Never connect the dots. It's the booze. Never connect the dots. If it was just that, though, if it was just this idea that I have this allergy of the body, then Dr. Silkworth's remedy was, when you leave here, don't drink again, would work for a guy like me. and I wouldn't have to spend my time here with you this weekend. I wouldn't have to do the things that I'm required to do in order to go out and be semi-normal in the world today, or at least appear to be to people, you know, run around kind of undetected, right? I wouldn't have to do, I would just not drink and I'd be okay. But it's the other piece of the puzzle. It's the other piece of the puzzle that I have, and that's the piece that drives people like my wife and the people who loves us absolutely insane. It's the other piece of the puzzle that makes people who never have a drop of alcohol die early of hypertension, heart attacks, right? It's that piece of the puzzle, and it looks something like this. I come home, and my wife is cooking dinner. Now, what you need to know is what Lori did tell you is Lori's my fourth wife. I mean, you need a program almost up here to keep up with this stuff. So it really doesn't matter which one because they all would fit the same bill. But they would be cooking dinner. We'll just use Lori. And she would say, hey, I'm cooking dinner. Dinner's going to be ready in an hour. I need a loaf of bread. Go get it. And I say, I'm on it. So on a Thursday night, it's about 6 o'clock, I go get a loaf of bread. And I go to the homeland and I run in and I get the bread and I'm coming out. And when I come out, I run into my friend Jimmy back there. And Jimmy says, what are you doing? And I tell him, Lori's cooking dinner and she needed bread and I got it. And it's going to be ready. And it's going to be ready in 50 minutes and I got to get home. And then Jimmy says something like this. 50 minutes. 50 minutes. Well, hey, man, we could go over the log in, have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. Now, when I get information like that, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind. I know y'all are familiar with that. Because AA is the only place you'll ever hear about the keen alcoholic mind. Let me assure you that. I will promise you this. Over in the Al-Anon rooms, they are not talking about the keen alcoholic mind over there. But I get that information. I filter it through the keen alcoholic mind. I think 50 minutes, two beers, I can do that. So on a Thursday night, Jimmy and I go to the log in to have two beers. I got 50 minutes, I'll be home. Now, Sunday when I get home, everybody's mad at me. I mean, she's mad, the kids are mad, the cat's mad, the dog's mad. I don't know why. I got the damn bread. I don't know why they're mad. Apparently, bigger deal to this one-hour time requirement than I really gave credence to, right? And I don't know if you've ever been in a jackpot like that, but when I get in a jackpot like that, I got to tell the story. And my God, we are full of stories here. If we go to the bathroom, somebody will come back and say, you won't believe this. And they'll tell a story about going and peeing. I mean, it's just a story. We are storytellers, man. But I like to get everybody gathered up in one spot. And the reason I like to do that is because I don't want to end up in a camp in Wyoming. I get them in front of me so I can see them, right? So, and I begin telling them the story. I left. I went to the store. I got the bread. I came out. And when I came out and I'm getting ready to tell them about I ran into Jimmy, and in my head, the tumblers click and they say, my God, this was Jimmy's fault. And I tell them and I ran to Jimmy and he talked me into going to go. And then here I go. Right. And I'm telling them the story and I'm putting the spin on the story from my perspective as I see it. And I got to tell you something. I'm an unreliable narrator of my life. Totally unreliable. It amazes me today that anybody wants me to tell it, right? And I tell the story. When I get to the end of the story, I do exactly like that person this morning did. I look into the eyes of the people I love the most, right? I look into the eyes of my wife, my children, my mom, my dad, my brother, grandparents. Does it really matter? I look into their eyes and I tell them the same thing I've told them countless times. But I can guarantee you one thing. I'm never going to do that again. And the crazy part about that is, as much as I believe Jimmy was the problem, I believe my own stuff. You can strap a lie detector to me, I'll pass it. I really believe I'll never do it again. And the next morning I get up and it's still pretty chilly at my house. You know, they're not so easy to forget. And I get in traffic and I go downtown to my office downtown. And on my way through traffic downtown, I get to downtown. And then I begin to think about how they don't treat me right at work. Right? I begin to think about, you know, I don't really get the respect that I deserve at work. I mean, after all, I'm down there busting my hump 2-3 hours a day. I mean, I'm killing it at work. I mean, I'm really tossing it up down there, you know. And I get back in my car when the day's over and I start to go home. And somewhere in that period of time, what happened is this thought comes to me. They just need to get over that. I mean, I apologized yesterday. And I'm going to tell you, when a guy like me hits that thought, I maybe have 12, 24 on a really good stretch, 36 hours. And what's going to happen for alcoholic of my type, I'm going to find myself back in a bar or somebody's house, or I'm going to be two drinks in, not remembering how I started. And it's that piece of the puzzle, that piece of the puzzle that I can't adequately answer, and that piece of the puzzle which they cannot understand. If I tell you this morning I'll never drink again, and by 2 in the afternoon I'm drinking again, I'm drinking against my own will. I believe this morning. I hear all the time people talking about my drug of choice. Alcohol is my drug of no choice. When my mind says drink, I'm drinking. I'm just drinking. And my life is a series of that. My life is a series of vain attempts. I remember in the 80s, they thought some people thought I had a drinking problem, and they suggested I go to treatment. And, I hold a professional license, and they said, if you don't go, we're going to get your professional license taken away. I'm not a dummy. And so they put me on a plane. They sent me to Arizona for 30 days out there and in the hot summer sunshine. And I came back, and I don't want you, the people, to think and not or to believe, leave here under the misinformation that I didn't think I had some kind of problem in the 80s when they sent me. I really believed I did have a problem. It seemed to me it was a back problem. Everybody was on mine, and I needed to get them off. And so I went out there to do that. And I came back here, and they said, you need to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came here, and I sat in your chair, and I drank your coffee, and I chased your girls around, caught one. Took yet one more hostage. We produced a hostage yet. And I didn't change anything about my life. And I'm in Dallas, and I start drinking again. And I remember one Sunday, I'm in Norman, Oklahoma, and it's on a Sunday night. I've been drinking all day because Sundays are great days to drink. And I went to the bathroom. And I always tell this for the ladies, because I'm looking in this crowd tonight at all the ladies in the room tonight, knowing none of you have ever been to a men's restroom before. And so, except you, ma'am. And so, I always feel like I got to explain. Now, ladies, in men's restrooms, there's all different types. Some of them are nice places like this. They have the urinals with the little dividers in it, which is really nice. You get a sense of privacy. But sometimes, like at some bars and football stadiums, we just have this big old hog trough we all belly up to. And so this is a hog trough night, so just so you're clear about it. And so I'm in the bathroom, and this guy comes in next to me. And, of course, you know, ladies, out of etiquette, you just mind your own space over here. But this guy was doing something. He had a lot of activity going on over here where he was, and it caught my attention. And so I'm watching him out of the corner of my eye, and he pulls out what appears to be the world's smallest baby spoon. I've never seen one this small. And he's got this little brown vial, and he begins to put things up his nose, and I'm fascinated. I mean, I'm just fascinated now. And ladies, what you need to know, if you're in a men's bathroom, what you don't ever want to have happen is get caught looking at the guy next to you, you know? It's not good, John, is it? Well, he caught me. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm a guy, I'm a real live alcoholic, and I've got some rules. I've got some rules about my drinking. I'm anti-drug. I don't do drugs. I mean, I'm Nancy Reagan, right? Just say no. I'm all that stuff. You know, I don't do drugs. I'm a drinker. Now, I'll smoke a little reefer with you, but I'm talking about drugs. You know, but this guy catches me, and what he does is he just puts that little spoon in that vial, and he just begins to take it under my nose. I'm going to tell you, in the 2 seconds that probably took, yeah, that happened, you know, right? The 2 seconds. What happened to me is I got captured by fear. I don't know I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. I don't know that whatever decisions I've made up to this point, that once I start drinking, another guy begins to call the shots in my life. That once I start drinking, whatever decision I made prior to that, that once I start drinking, another guy begins to call the shots in my life. And so what happened was he just leaned that over, so I just took a big whiff, because it seemed to me that's what he did, that I just doing what he did. And he put one on my other nostril. I just took another big whiff. Now, what I want to tell you all about that night is this. Every time that guy went to the bathroom, I followed him in. That's what I did. And I'm going to tell you something. I found a cure for the blackouts. And I'll also tell you this. I became the unofficial night watchman in my neighborhood. If you want to catch me about 4 in the morning, I got the lookout going on, man. It was an uncompensated position, by the way. But I'm watching the neighborhood. You ever get frozen at the blinds? Just froze. And you look down and you go, I've been here for 3 hours. I don't know what happened to me. But what I can tell you about that is what our textbook tells us about that is that we'll do all kind of stuff to try to manage and control our drinking. You know, and what I found out is that cocaine is like Gatorade for the drinking man. You just have some of that, you just go again, right? You just stay up, you beat the blackouts. And I found a way to manage the blackouts. And, you know, I came home one time after being in Dallas, and I went back to my room. My little girl was 3 years old. It was a couple days before Christmas. And I went back to my bedroom, and I began to pack everything in some black garbage bags that was important to me. Now, at this time in my life, I'm one of these guys that the book talks about. I build up this bright future for my people. And just right on the cusp of everything being great, I just pull the whole structure down. And I tell you this story not because I need you to know what a big shot I was, because I thought myself enough big shot. But at the time, I had this, I don't know, 32 years old. I was a first name partner in a 15-man law firm in downtown Oklahoma City. And we had the whole floor of one of those big, tall office buildings in downtown Oklahoma City. I had about 16 people that worked. I had 15 lawyers and 16 support staff that reported all directly to me. I'm somebody. And I'm a big shot. What I've discovered is a big shot's just a squirt under pressure. That's all I found out. But, you know, in my mind, I'm somebody. And I tell you that story because it's important to realize, because I think alcohol is a great taker. You'll have people come behind this podium and they say things like this. Well, I lost this behind my drinking, or I lost that behind my drinking. And I get what they're saying, but I need you to understand one thing really clear. I never lost anything. I gave it away. If I tell you I lost something, I could kick a rock tomorrow and find it, and there it would be. But I gave it away. I traded it away to live the kind of life my mind tells me that I need to live. And 2 days before Christmas, when I came home and I began to go back there, got those 7 black garbage bags, I began to fill them with everything that was important in my life. And my little 3-year-old daughter, who was 2 days before Christmas, every time I would carry a bag out, she would grab my leg and hang on to it. And she's crying and saying, Daddy, please don't go. Please don't go. I don't know what alcoholism looks like on you, and I don't pretend to know what it does to you. But let me tell you about this alcoholic. I'll step over anybody and anything to live the kind of life my mind tells me to live. And I stepped right over that little girl and packed that car so I could get on with my life. And, of course, you know, she petitioned to be set free. And, of course, they set her and the hostage free. And I began to have this deal where I just quit showing up for work. And I had this, I'd met Lori somewhere along the way. I didn't know she was untreated Al-Anon, but it seemed to me the horns in my head seemed to fit the holes in hers. And we began to do the alcoholic dance. I couldn't have told you that's what it was at the time, but we began to do the alcoholic dance. And, she started running me around to try to get me fixed. And we went to psychiatrist and psychologist, and eventually the therapist sent us someplace, and this lady had me figured out in 2 visits. I didn't know she'd been a member of Al-Anon for 8 years, so check out your doctors before you go to see them, that's all I'm saying. Ask them a few questions, you know. And so we went, and on the 3rd visit, I'd been up for 2 or 3 days, and we go to see her, and she's figured me out. And she tells Lori, listen, I'm going to give you this script for tranquilizers. When you get home, give him one about 5. If he's still up at 10, give him another one. Now, that's what she said. What I heard was, we're going to have to triple up on everything to beat this deal. That's what I heard. And so I had plenty of schizophrenic blackouts in my time, but this particular night, I had a schizophrenic whiteout. That's all I need to tell you. And I had, at 10 o'clock, I was still up at 10, and she gave me another one because I'm going hard. And The next morning, I had barricaded myself in a room, because that's what you do. And she broke in, which apparently is not a big challenge for people like her, and broke in on me. And there I was, naked to the world, and there was an empty quart of vodka and an empty quart of wine. I had pulled the TV set up right by the bed because you can see the pornography better if it's right there, and you got to keep it low so they don't hear it on the other side of the house. So I'd pulled it up. There was a blue screen on the TV where they had run out, and on top of the stack of adult videos up here, there was a little small bag with some white substance on it. And she broke in that morning, and I'm going to tell you what, she took that baggie, and I swear to God, she hit me like I'd been shot out of a cannon. And I mean, and she shook that bag of dope at me. She said, "What the hell is this?" Now, let me tell you something. Before my drinking career overtook my legal career, I had been a fairly decent trial lawyer. And I had made my living convincing jury of your peers, driver's license holders, that whatever side of the case it was on, you know, the job of any good lawyer, trial lawyer particularly, is we're given a set of facts. And when your client gives you a set of facts, what your job is to do is to hear those and begin to weave the theory of how this all happened. So at the end of the case, when you deliver that to the trier of facts, you do a summation of the facts. So when they go and retire to deliberate, they're going to go back with a story in their head that they understand the facts as you've told it to them to bring back a verdict in favor of your client. And I was good at that. I'd probably tried 50, 60 jury trials. And the deal about trying jury trials is you got to be fast on your feet. You got to think about things quickly. When you're presented with things, you've got to make snap decisions, put a set of theory and facts together to argue so you can win on whatever it might be. Well, on this particular morning, after being shot out of a cannon, and she shook that bag of dope at me, she said, "What the hell is this?" I had to do that. I had to come up with the facts and the theories in order for me to convince her how this happened. And the best argument I had on that particular morning was, "I don't know. I don't know what that is. I think those people dropped it when they barricaded me in here this morning." There was some discussion about whose house it was, best I remember, and on that particular day it was more her house than mine, and I got asked to leave, and that's okay. That was June the 30th of 2001. That's not my sobriety date, but it's an important date to me. It's the day I came back to you. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous with a desire to get sober. I came back with a desire to get back in the house. And I said this earlier today, I don't believe that you have to come to AA with a desire to be sober. I think it's important that you just come here. And I don't think it really matters why you come here. I've got a buddy of mine that got sentenced to one AA meeting. And he's never left. He's 32 years sober. He got sentenced to one AA meeting. He came here and he said, and he heard the music. And he never left. That baffles me. But he heard it. So I developed my very first newcomer plan on June the 30th of 2000. If you're new here, you need a newcomer plan. I'm just going to tell you mine. If you don't have a newcomer plan, you may not be alcoholic. I mean, just saying. Just kind of talking to you here. You got to have a newcomer plan. Here's my newcomer plan. I'm going to go to AA, 30, 60 days, get her calmed down. And then I'm going to go back to just living my life the way I want to live it. Now, listen, I hadn't worked for 3 years. I had become such a deal. I mean, I'm missing court. I got evicted from that building in downtown Oklahoma City. Lori had this great job that she had. I like to tell people after we got evicted and I kind of passed around for a while, and I kind of like to tell people that's when I became a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife that worked. I became a real go-getter. I'd take her to work and go get her. That's what I would do. So I ain't worked in 3 years, and I go to AA, and I got this newcomer plan. I'm going to do that, get her kind of pacified, and I'm going to slowly go back living my life. And that's what I did. That was my plan. And I came to AA just not drinking. I discovered something. I sat in AA for 45 days of those first 60, and thinking this. These were my thoughts. How do I drink, and how do I stay sober? How do I drink and how do I stay? Because any given moment, you know, I'm the smartest guy in the room. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to beat the laws of physics and figure out how to drink and not get drunk. I'm going to figure it out. And so all I could do was sit in AA and think, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? How do I drink? That's all I could think about. And I'm listening to you people. You sound like Charlie Brown's people. You won't, 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 won't. It's all I hear. How do I drink? How do I stay sober? I discovered something in those 45 days. I'm not like my friends. You remember my friends that drank with me and they quit drinking and their lives got better? They got houses and cars and families. See, I quit drinking. I didn't get better. I got worse. I didn't know some things. The first thing I didn't know is I'm in the grips of a progressive illness. I don't know that over any considerable period of time, I get worse, not better. And I'm sitting in AA just not drinking. And I'm getting sicker, and I'm getting sicker, and I'm getting sicker. I don't know about how you people are. I don't know what your head does to you. I'm a chatterhead. It just goes. It likes to talk to me. It likes especially talk to me about 3 in the morning. Get up. We've been up for an hour. We need to get you in this conversation. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. Hey. All right, I'm in. It just goes. And I'm going to tell you, on the 45th day, I got up out of a noon meeting on a Thursday. I went directly to a bar and I started drinking. Because I couldn't live another minute sober. I couldn't do it. And I started drinking on Thursday and I came home on Sunday. And she met me at the door, you know, where have you been? And she wanted to do a drug test, which was way over the top, I thought, you know. And I started negotiating for time because that's important, you know. I need some time. Come to find out again, more her house than mine that night, you know. And I went to a guy's house and I detoxed on his couch for 2 or 3 days. And on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat down. I didn't know it was going to be the day that I sat down here. I mean, really, who does, right? I mean, if we could just as well get a dart and throw it at a calendar, it'd be just as good a day as the day I sat down. I had no idea on that day I was never going to drink again. I had no clue. That was not my MO. I had a revised newcomer plan. My new newcomer plan, phase 2, was I'm going to go 60 or 90 days because, man, I really got to get her calmed down now, you know. 60, 90 days. I got to figure out how to get over that 45-day hump, apparently, but I can figure it out because I'm a figure-outer. You know, all my days I say people bring me problems, and I figure it out. I can figure this out. I can figure it out. And, man, I'm sitting in AA on August the 15th, 2001. The head's just going. It's got a lot of information up there. How do we drink? How do we stay sober? There's like 5 minutes left in this AA meeting, and my head goes stone cold quiet. I'm going to tell you something. If you're a chatterhead, that's an attention getter. And I sat straight up. And a new thought came to me. And what I'm going to tell you today about this thought is I know for a fact. It's a thought that did not originate in me. And the reason I know that is the only thoughts I've had to that point is how do I drink and how do I stay sober? And on that day when my head went quiet and I sat straight up, this thought came to me. If you don't do something different today, you're going to die. You know. And it got my attention. And about 5 minutes later, you good people got up and circled up and grabbed your hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And at the end of that Lord's Prayer, I had done on that day, on August the 15th, 2001, what I'd been doing every time I came to AA. I broke for the door. And in this little room I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous at, there was 2 ways in to the meeting hall. Now, what I'd tell you about it is those days I'd been going to Alcoholics Anonymous, those 45 days, there'd been an old man there. And every day when you good people would say your prayer, I'd just break for the door. Old Don would catch me. And he would look at me and he'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I would give him the BS alcoholic answer. Fine. Fine, you know, fine. And he would just look at me and he'd say, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I'd be like, man, if there ever is, then I'm gone. After about a week, I got hip to Don catching me. And so I would give him a head fake. Like I'm going to go to that door. But I discovered a strange thing about alcoholics. They're a lot like Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise. They just beam their ass down right there, right? I think I'm going there and he's right here. I mean, he just beams down there. Catch me. On August the 15th, 2001, old Don caught me one more time. We'll tell you about Don. You know him. I know you know him. He's always at the meetings 30 minutes early. And he's always there. He's setting up the tables. He's making the coffee, putting the literature out. It's annoying, really. And if he's not doing that, he's out in the front room, kind of in the ante room, you know. And he's always got two or three what I called acolytes out there, you know. And all they know are three things: read, write, pray. That's all they know out there. Read, write, pray. Read, write, pray. That's all they're doing out there. Read, write, pray. And then they would float into the meeting, you know, Don and the acolytes. They would float in, and then the meeting would start, and then they would have announcements, you know, like at your home group. Does anybody have any AA-related announcements? And my God, Don, it seemed like every meeting, he would go on and on and on about everything going on in AA worldwide. Sometimes 60 to 90 seconds. I mean, forever. Forever, about everything going on. And if there was a newcomer at the meeting, my God, Don and the acolytes were on them like a chicken on a June bug. I mean, just in attack mode, you know. And the acolytes are giving books and writing down numbers. And old Don would hang back and he'd get the acolytes would all clear out. And old Don would do something that the acolytes, I noticed, wouldn't do. Not only was he giving numbers, but he was getting the newcomer's number. What Don knew that the acolytes had not figured out yet, that no alcoholic can pick up the 10,000-pound phone and call. So Don would call. And on August 15th, 2001, he catches me one more time, and he looks at me and he said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I'm going to tell you something. On that day, I gave him a different answer. I said, "Man, I'm not doing good at all." And he looked at me and he said, "I know." And he said, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you." And I said, "Man, I need a sponsor." And I'm going to tell you something. It was like somebody had plugged Don into an electric outlet. I mean, he got excited. I thought he was going to pee his pants. I mean, he just got so excited. And it was like, and Don's 10 years sober. He's 65. He's retired. He goes, "Well, that's a lot to ask of somebody." I'm thinking, I didn't ask. I just made a statement, right? He said, "That's a lot to ask of somebody. So let's sit down and talk about that." And old Don pulled up a chair, and he began to talk to me about what he was like, what had happened, and what he was like today. And I told you I'd been to treatment, that they'd been sentenced to AA, and I'd been going to AA. But see, I'm not alcoholic. And the crazy thing about alcoholism is, until I know I've got it, I can't hear you. Until I believe that's me, it what you're talking is Charlie Brown stuff to me. It's just wonk, wonk. It has no purpose for me. If that's not me, this is just information I don't need to overload my circuits with, so it doesn't mean anything to me. But I'm going to tell you, on that moment in time, right there when Don sat down, he began to talk to me. He brought me a message of depth and weight. He was a guy properly armed with the facts about himself. He didn't talk to me for any kind of moral or spiritual high top. He just talked to me about what he was like, what had happened to him, and what he was like today as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of his understanding that he had found when he got here. And he talked to me about that. And I can't tell you if we were there for 20 minutes, 2 hours, or 2 days. I really don't know. But what I can tell you this is, it's just, we talk about it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our textbook talks about that moment of incomprehensible demoralization. We toss it around the rooms. We talk about the gift of desperation. It's just grace. It's just grace. And grace falls on all of us. I'm not one of those believers that the God that I believe in, you know, chooses me and not chooses somebody else. I don't believe that. I think grace falls on all of us. But alcoholics are selfish. And when grace sometimes falls on us, we come here and we're new and we get back in the house early, or we get the job back, and she comes home or he comes home, or they let us back in the house, and we reach up, we pull the window that grace has entered into, we pull it down. And we stifle grace out. Donald was a student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In that chapter, We Agnostics, it talks about a couple kind of people in there. One of them being that we could be the kind of people who look at the world and think that it's just spinning nowhere into nothingness. Or we could take the position that we're God's intelligent agents, ever advancing His creation and His universe. And Don was one of those intelligent agent people, right? And I don't know if this is true or not, but I like the way I tell this part of the story, so I always tell it this way, is that I believe every morning Don got up, looked in the mirror, and said, God, the agent Don's showing up for work today. And I don't know what you got for me, but I'm willing to go out and find what it is. And every day Don got up and he came fishing in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a knucklehead like me. Grace. And I'm going to tell you something. You know, O'Don, in all those times when he would catch me, he never once pulled me up short and say, listen, here's what you need to do. You need to get this book. You need to go to 90 meetings. He didn't do any of that stuff. He offered me friendship and fellowship. And when I didn't want that, he stepped out of the way and he allowed whiskey to do the job. He allowed whiskey to do the job that's necessary, I believe, for any alcoholic to come here and to surrender. What our textbook talks about, you know, I had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. That next line in our book is one of my favorites. For some of us, this was a tedious process, right? I had to take a lot of ass whoopings to get here, right? And on that day, what happened was, in that moment of grace, when the grace came through the window before I could reach up and pull it shut, Don got through. He carried a message of hope through that window. And I'm going to tell you something. At the end of his presentation, again, I don't know how long it lasted, but I'm like some kind of high-stakes poker player in Vegas. I just pushed all my chips to the middle of the table. And on that day, on August the 15th, 2001, I bet it all on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went all in on that day. And I'm going to tell you something. I've been all in on AA from that date to this very moment right here. And I'm going to tell you that not for you to say that, or you to believe that since I've been here, it's all been unicorns and lollipops. I don't want you to think that I slid off the back of a rainbow every day and it's just good. Because you'll have people come up behind this podium and they'll tell you how good life has been since they got sober, as if nothing bad has ever happened to them since John Barleycorn was put on the shelf. They're charlatans. And they're trying to sell you a bill of goods. Because that does not reconcile with what my book says. My book says that when we come here, there's an obligation we have on our part. And that is to perfect, to make better, and to enlarge, to make bigger our spiritual life. For what? The certain trials and low spots ahead. And I don't know about you, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what life looked like for me. It's like I'm on the front row of a Def Leppard concert right in front of the speakers. And it's blowing on me. And it seems to me that life is blowing on me and it's happening to me. It just seems like it's happening to me. And I'm going to tell you something. Since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and Don began to take me through that book and he began to have me do the actions out of that book, and he had me when it said write, we wrote. When it said pray, we got on our knees. Don was a knee prayer. We got on our knees when we were to pray. He had me out talking to people, making amends. At 3 months sober, he had me carrying meetings into treatment centers. He had me active in Alcoholics Anonymous, not with the activities, but within the actions necessary for me to have the conversion experience that our 12-step promises, that spiritual awakening. And I'm going to tell you something. I had that. I got that through the by a process of the steps. I got woke up in here. I came awake. You know, at first it's just like a flicker. It's like I'm coming out of this dream. It's that fog we're in when we stop drinking and we begin to see the realities of our life. Don talked to me about hope. I begin to watch him and I get 30, 60, 90 days. And I've never had that since I took that first drink when I was 11 years old. And my God, I'm sober 30, 60, 90 days. And I begin to do the actions in here and I begin to follow those people around. And the demonstrations they made allowed me to come to believe that this could work for me. The hope that they demonstrated, what they talked about, how they carried themselves, their whole deportment, shouted, these were people with a real answer. And I began to follow them around. And I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And about nine years, I became what I like to call over-sober here. I became the sheriff of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to tell you how you were doing it wrong, why you were doing it wrong. I quit sharing my experience, and I begin to tell you what to do. I don't know if you know this or not. It's not very attractive, right? And I'm telling people what to do, and I'm gossiping about that group, and I'm talking about how they're not doing it right. I'm a disunifier in AA. You know, those 12 traditions we talk about, I'm out of gate one. I'm breaking up the whole deal, man. I'm a disunifier. And one day I came home, and my wife meets me, and she sets me down, and she goes, I don't know who you are. And we have a sober home. And that just doesn't mean physically sober. That means physically, spiritually, emotionally, and that ain't you. And you got to go. And at 9 years sober, I was chairing our area conference. I was the alternate area chair. I mean, I was making my name for myself in an anonymous program, you know, which in and of itself is a form of insanity here. You know, I had ascended to guru status here, you know. And I didn't fuss. I just said, okay, because I've learned if somebody says you have a tail, you need to look. And I went and moved in. I remember the day I sat down with my sponsor and began to tell him this tale of woe of me. And I remember looking at him and saying this to him. And you ever said something to your sponsor and think, well, maybe he didn't hear it. Maybe I could just go on to another conversation. Or it comes out and you think, I'm just going to grab it and get it back. And I remember when this came out of when they crossed my lips, it was like God had a little hammer went, dink. And I said, man, Don, I got to get back to basics as if there's some other level we ascend to here. Like, I'm here and maybe you people can one day get here. But until then, I'll just minister to you, right? And I remember crossing my lips and thinking, my God, all we have here are the basics. All we have here is trust God, clean house, and help others. That's all we have. We don't have anybody here that ascends to anything other than sober. It's the highest we get to here. And I'm going to tell you, for 3 months, what I did was I did what I did when I first got here. I poured myself back into treatment work. I poured myself back into helping other people harder than I have. Because our book tells us we have trouble with stuff. The only remedy we got here is to go help other people. That's all we have here. There's no pixie dust we sprinkle on you. There's nothing we can do. Our remedy is trust God, clean house, help others. That's it. If you come in here and you're looking for something else, that's all we have. That's all we have here. Whatever problem I've ever brought to my sponsor, it ends with, have you prayed about it and who have you helped? That's all he wants to talk about. It's kind of boring, but that's all he's got, you know. But that seems to work. And I poured myself back into that. And I'm going to tell you, you know, what's happened for me is, through a direct result of the steps, is I've not changed my seat in life. My seat hasn't changed in life. I'm still at the same concert. I'm still in the front row. I'm still right in front of the amplifiers. But I'm going to tell you something. Even though it blows, the steps have given me a modulator for the volume of life. And while it still blows, I'm able to modulate that down to reality, to where I see it's just happening. It's not happening to me. It's just happening. And I'm going to tell you something. Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that I found here has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I can remember early on thinking, if I can just ever get back to work. You know, if I can just get somewhere where I can get back to work, you know. I got evicted from that building in downtown Oklahoma City, and I was about 3 years sober, and I was back working again, and I've been working for about a year. It took me about a year and a half to get back working. I did AA. My sponsor drugged me around, and I knew I had some guys said, you got to get back to work. And an old bail bondsman and a criminal lawyer, they scooped me up and they started feeding me cases, and I began to get back to work. And come to find out, when I'm sober, I'm a decent lawyer. Who knew? And I started getting really, really busy. And I called Don one day and I said, hey, listen, man, I need to move back downtown. And there was this long pause. And he said, well, the last time you moved downtown, that was a train wreck. He said, I got to think about that. And then he kind of concluded the conversation, and he never talked about it again. And I knew not to bring it up. I mean, it's like when your mom tells you no. All right, it's no. I mean, that's over. But about 2 months later, he said, I've been thinking about that. I go, about what? He said, about you moving back downtown. And he said, I think you can do that, but you got to be responsible for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day in downtown Oklahoma City. And at that time, there wasn't an AA meeting in downtown Oklahoma City. And I'd gotten back in the stream of life, and I'd been going downtown. And one of the last amends I had to make was to the building I got evicted from. And so I had to go back to them. Since I was going back downtown, I had to go back. I went back to them, set up an appointment, and said, "Hey, I know you threw me out of here, and I know I owe you some money, and I need to know how much that is." And of course, they knew. They had a file. And they said, "This is how much it'll be." And I said, "Well, I need to pay you." And so we made a deal, and I paid them what I owed them. And then I said, "And by the way, I need to move back downtown, and I'd like to come back here." And they said, "Cliff, we'd love to have you. You're going to pay a little bigger deposit this time, but we'd love to have you here." And I said, "Great, I'm willing to do that." And I said, "Oh, by the way, one more thing." I said, "If I wanted to come back downtown," of course, they knew my story, because you just don't get evicted from a building in downtown, wherever you are, that people don't know about it, right? And they knew. And I said, I'm charged with starting an AA meeting down here. Do you have any kind of little space I could have?" And there was a closet they had, and I said, "I'll take it." And the deal we made with them, whatever we took in, they could have half of it. And it started out the first day we had a meeting. There was eight people that showed up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been 17 years ago, and that little meeting still exists in downtown Oklahoma City. And it gets all kind of people. We got people from the street. We'll have rock stars, movie stars that come through town, that stay downtown, that come. It's an eclectic bunch. And you never know really what you're going to get. It's kind of like a box of chocolates. You know what I mean? I mean, you never know who's going to show up there that day or what they're going to get. But one thing's for sure, what they get there is they get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They get a message carried out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I can tell you about all that is this, there was a little boy, and he was running down the road one day. And he came across a poster, and the poster said, "Puppies for Sale." And he read that, and he looked at where the place was that had the puppies, and he took off for the old farmer's house, just beating as fast as he could get there. And he got there, and he's probably 7, 8 years old, and he gets there, and the old farmer's out feeding the animals that morning. He came up and said, Mister, "I got to have one of those puppies." And the old farmer looked at him and said, "Son," said, these are high-powered dogs. These aren't just, handed out dogs. They're going to cost some money." He said, "Oh, I just got to have one." He said, "Well, how much do you have?" And the little boy dug in his pockets. 57 cents. He said, "Well, it's going to cost a lot more than 57 cents for a puppy here." And the little boy hung his head. He said, "Well, how much to look at them, mister?" He said, 57 cents. And the little boy gave him the money, and the farmer turned around, "Ginger." And out of the doghouse came the mama dog, and she ran down the little ramp there, and four little fuzzballs came out, kind of ran down. They began to play out there, and little boy just leaned into the fence, man, and his eyes got big, and he's watching those pups dance around out there. And out of the corner of his eye, he catches something over in the doghouse, another fuzzball. Doesn't run down, kind of rolls down the ramp, and it gets out smaller than the rest, and they're butting him around. And I'm telling you what, the little boy just leans in harder. And he says, "That's him, mister. That's the one right there. That's the one I want right there." And the old farmer bent down. He just kind of came down to him right on his level. He says, "Son, you don't want that dog." He said, "That dog's a runt." He said, "He's a cripple." He said, "He ain't never going to run and play with you like the other dogs do." And the little boy took a step back. And he pulled up his blue jeans, and he had two metal rods that ran down each side. And he said, "That's okay, mister. See, I don't run so good either. And that dog right there, he's going to need somebody who understands." And the old farmer got up, and he reached down, and he scooped up the pup, and he handed it to the little boy. And the little boy looked at him. He said, "How much, sir?" And the old farmer looked at him. He said, "Paid in full." He said, "Your love will be enough." And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here a cripple. I walked through that door broken and beaten, and an old man stood by the door, and his love was enough. Thanks for having us.